Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron, delivering gourmet recipes and fresh ingredients right to your door. Listeners get their first three meals free at blueapron.com/takeaway. That's blueapron.com/takeaway.
Happy Friday! This is The Takeaway for August 5th, 2016.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And this week, President Obama wrote a fascinating essay on feminism for Glamour magazine, celebrating the emergence of his two daughters into adulthood and noting that the past 8 years have been quietly revolutionary for women, even if equal pay and equal status still eludes them. Obama, in his 1,500-word essay, seemed to be most proud of how his girls were instilled with a zero-tolerance attitude for the old boys' clubs and all of the stereotypes about traditional roles for men and women that he grew up with. Shedding outmoded gender roles is the hard work of changing ourselves rather than laws and rules, he said. Quoting the president now, that's what 21st century feminism is all about. The idea that when everybody is equal, we are all more free. Well, have things changed? When allegations first surfaced about Fox News chief Roger Ailes systematically harassing female employees, they were in a book published 2 years ago and no one paid any attention. But when this year a number of women called out Roger Ailes for degrading sexual harassment and boorish demanding of sexual favors, he was packing up his office. So we begin with an outmoded gender role we found in the high-powered advertising business and how one woman called it out. And today, unlike a decade ago, insensitive executives can't run to the old boys' network for protection when they say such things about women to the media. They're bounced out. In an interview with Business Insider, the towering head of advertising firm Saatchi & Saatchi, Kevin Roberts, said he believed the debate over gender diversity in advertising is all effing over. I'm not exactly quoting there, as you can tell. He also suggested that women hold only 12% of creative director positions in the industry because women don't want to take on management positions. They have no, quote, vertical ambition, were his precise words. He even went after a feminist champion, advertising consultant Cindy Gallup, saying she's making up a lot of the stuff to create a profile and to take applause and to get on a soapbox. Gallup's soapbox is equal pay and gender equality in the ad industry. Cindy Gallup, who is the former president of the ad agency Bartle, Bogle & Hegarty, called out Roberts. Social media did the rest, and boom, Roberts resigned. Gallup had this message for Saatchi & Saatchi yesterday.
I note that they now have a leadership coach vacancy, and I would like to offer my services for this. I'm very happy to be hired in Kevin Roberts' place. Obviously, very importantly, so there's no suggestion of a gender wage gap at all, that would be on the same salary as Kevin Roberts, $4 million.
Cindy Gallup says this case shows how, as President Obama suggests, it may be a great time to be a woman, but Kevin Roberts' attitude shows there's still lots of work to do.
I've no idea where those remarks came from. I was very taken aback to hear them. But I guess, you know, that's the kind of anger that arises when somebody who is very comfortably entrenched in the old world order...
Emphasize comfortably.
Wow, gosh. Yeah. Well, let's say very comfortably, yeah. As in on a huge salary, enormous bonuses. You know, Kevin Roberts was paid $4 million last year to operate as the chairman of Saatchi & Saatchi Worldwide with the charge of inspiring all of the many women who work for Saatchi's around the world as a leadership coach charged with creating and developing the leaders of the future and as an agency representative for a vast number of clients who sell brands, products and services to millions of women. So sitting very comfortably in that context and making comments very much at odds with the things that he's been charged and paid and rewarded handsomely to do.
How is this different from political correctness?
Political correctness is a phrase that is often brought up to address things that people would rather were not happening. And I must admit, I can't remember who said this, but it reminds me of that wonderful quote, "When you are used to privilege, equality feels like oppression."
Mm.
And so we're talking about an industry who sells to women as the primary purchasers of everything and the primary influencer purchasers of everything, but which is still massively dominated by men, especially at the top and especially where it really matters in the creative department, creating the advertising that is our output to the world. And so, like every other industry, we need to welcome in gender equality, diversity and equal leadership opportunities for all in order to better reflect the consumers that we are charged with communicating with and compelling to want to buy our clients' products.
But this isn't simply about, you know, boy, girl, boy, girl, boy, girl in the, you know, cafeteria. The idea that women don't have vertical ambition is just daft. I mean, I don't know where what women is he talking about?
To be frank, John, you know, I think that is a function of the fact that at the top of our industry, as at the top of every other industry, is a closed loop of white guys talking to white guys about other white guys. Those white guys up at the top are sitting very pretty. They have their gigantic salaries, huge bonuses, stock options, expense accounts. Why would they ever want to rock the boat? Because the system is working for them just fine as it is. And so this is a way of post-rationalizing why there aren't any women up there. Oh, no, 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 they don't want to be. And let's just carry on operating the way we always have because that suits us just fine.
Ironically, though, we're at a point where if you say something like that, that is rocking the boat. I mean, he's out.
Here's what, you know, is particularly perturbing about this episode. Every few months, a senior white man in our industry becomes a lightning rod for inappropriate comments, outmoded perspectives. What that says, John, is that change is not happening. Because if change were actually happening in this industry, Kevin Roberts would never have said publicly what he said in that interview. Mm. And so I think the very important thing for the industry to understand is that this is not about one bad apple. This is about rot through the top of our industry and quite a long way down that needs to be addressed as a whole. And I very much hope that, you know, the white men who run our industry will learn from this episode and move radically, swiftly and immediately to effect real change.
What's the Roger Ailes lesson, do you think, since it happened sort of around the same time here?
Oh, the Roger Ailes lesson is that exactly the same thing goes on in the advertising industry. One of the things Kevin Roberts said I was making up was the fact that sexual harassment is endemic in the advertising industry. And I cannot tell you how many emails I get from women in our industry all around the world sharing appalling stories, whom, by the way, I beg to talk to reporters, to be anonymous, and even when I guarantee their anonymity, they are too scared of retaliation. And they're quite right to be scared because they also write to me about said retaliation when you rebuff somebody's advances or, you know, you try and avoid the kind of situations that, unfortunately, the Roger Ailes saga has made very clear. Those go on in every industry dominated by white men at the top.
With the Roger Ailes case, I don't know how it could have gone on for so long. But then you have a very different perspective than I do.
Well, you know, I'm now so frustrated, John, by the glacial pace of change in my industry and others that I'm very pragmatic. There's a very simple answer to all of this, and that is get the numbers up as quickly as possible. Because the moment you have gender-equal working environments, or ideally, because it's been the other way for too long, more female than male working environments, you instantly manage out a whole host of negative dynamics without even having to address them directly. When you have a gender-equal working environment, you manage out sexual harassment. Because first of all, there is not the male-dominated, you know, implicit bro endorsement. It's okay for men to behave like that. And secondly, when men engage with women as professional equals and have as many women around them as men, they no longer see women in one of only two roles, girlfriend or secretary. So that really is the answer. You know, get the numbers up as quickly as possible, bulk buy, hire groups, not individuals, to change the ratio, and you will see a lot of negative dynamics go without even having had to address them directly.
Is that affirmative action?
I am all for affirmative action. So I occasionally get a woman saying to me, Cindy, I don't want to be hired just because I'm a woman. And my answer to that is, get over it. Because all around you are mediocre men who got hired because they were men. So get hired because you're a woman or a person of colour, and then do the bloody brilliant job in that role that you know you can do and demonstrate how much you deserve that position.
What's Donald Trump in all this? Some last stand of, you know, General Custer?
I think we're absolutely seeing this syndrome playing out in many different ways around the world, where the old world order does not like change and doesn't see how much the new world order would actually benefit them. We live in a world where the default setting is always male. Men, you have no idea how much happier you would be living and working in a world that was 50-50 equally informed, influenced, designed, led and driven by women just as much as men. And that's the world I'm trying to make happen.
Trump says that if you encounter sexual harassment, just, you know, find another employment, find another job.
It is not that easy, unfortunately. There are many, many people out there who don't have that luxury, who desperately need the job they have. There are many women out there, and also, by the way, some men, who are living with sexism and sexual harassment because they literally have no choice, and that is utterly soul-destroying. So the onus is not on women to adapt to an environment that is not welcoming of them and therefore is not tapping into enormous female, you know, talent, skills and contributions. The onus is on all of us, women and men alike, to understand that we can make so many more great things happen. And by the way, in every industry, you can actually reinvent your future and you can make so much more money when you welcome in this absolute wealth of innovation, disruption, talent and creativity you're currently missing out on. Women challenge the status quo because we are never it. Diversity is what drives true innovation. Innovation is the result of many different mindsets, perspectives, insights, worldviews coming together in constructive creative conflict to get to a far better place none of us could have gotten to on our own. That's the world we want to create.
As a parent, though, why would you advise your daughter if they're confronted with someone who's making a pass at them to simply go somewhere else as opposed to calling them out?
You absolutely should not advise them to just go somewhere else and not call it out. This is a message that I put out to my industry and the business world as a whole. I ask everybody, women and right-minded men, to call out any instance they see of harassment, abuse, gender bias, because if nobody speaks up, nothing changes. Change happens from the bottom up, not the top down. Every single one of us, every day, undertaking micro actions, tiny actions that are about changing all of this, cumulatively together at scale, we add up to enormous impact. Everybody can do something to change these situations that we do not want to have exist.
Cindy Gallup, advertising consultant, former president of the global ad agency Bartle Bogle Hegarty. Thank you so much.
Always a pleasure, John.
Recognize any of this? Have you been affected by sexism in the workplace? St. Louis, Missouri, of course. I'm a woman, subtle, constant. Men talk over you in meetings. If you show passion for what you do and the man doesn't agree with you, you're called emotional. Rockford, Illinois. I was told not to wear my pink pants to work because I was a man. I stopped wearing the pink pants.
This is Jen from Brooklyn. My last boss physically and verbally sexually harassed me and other female coworkers nonstop. I was terrified. I was a single mom in my 20s, and I needed a job. We had a small company with no HR department. It was just my boss and his partner, who was right there with him. When I left to start my own business, finally, all my female clients went with me.
Keep the conversation going. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or leave us a comment at facebook.com/thetakeaway. It is with some sadness and pride that Brazilians greet the opening of the 2016 Olympics. 7 years of preparation, 7 years of political turmoil that could peak right in the middle of these games. If the Brazilians can pull this off, they deserve a gold medal of their own. The arrival of the Olympic torch earlier in the week sparked protests by hundreds of demonstrators. Organizers report that more than 1 million tickets remain unsold. Juliana Barbosa is Brazilian-born and the author of Dancing with the Devil in the City of God, Rio de Janeiro on the Brink. She spoke to me from Rio just outside the Maracana Stadium where the opening ceremonies will take place, and she said there's no hiding the grim realities in Brazil right now with a few Olympic flags.
the problems are not going anywhere. I mean, the recession is upon us. The president will be facing an impeachment trial before the end of the month. And, you know, as I stand here looking at the stadium where the opening ceremony will take place tonight, there is a river of sewage that runs between me and the main door. So there is no more time to deal with any of that. This is the way that Rio's Olympics are going to go down.
Nevertheless, is there going to be a sense of escape, of pause from all the problems of Brazil while these games are happening? Or are Brazilians basically just hoping no disaster happens?
Brazilians are very proud of their country. They want Brazil to look good on television. They want people who have come here to feel comfortable. But security is an issue. Some athletes have had problems with robberies and things like that. The quality of the water in which some of the competitions are going to be held is also a problem. We're just keeping our fingers crossed that nothing bad will happen. But I don't think that there is a sense of pause, in all honesty. The president will face impeachment before this month is over. So it's very difficult for Brazilians to disconnect right now from the things that are weighing on them.
Well, careful viewers of the Olympics, what should they take away then as they watch the competition? But they're also going to see signs of everything you've described.
One of the biggest legacies, ironically, of the Rio Olympics is going to be a real questioning of the model of the current Olympics. The athletes deserve focus on them, and the people of the host cities deserve an Olympic Games that is affordable and sustainable. And I think this trend that we've seen towards ever bigger, ever more expensive games is failing on both those counts.
And describe the state of transportation, because of the infrastructure that was going to be built for the games that would matter, would actually live beyond the games. It was the light rail systems that were going to be put in place. How are they?
There are problems with the conception of the project. The light rail system, for example, goes in a circle around the touristy port area. The other projects, the bus rapid transit routes, all connect to the west side of Rio, which is where the main Olympic cluster is. It's also the wealthiest part of Rio with the most expensive real estate. So, you know, you just question not just the expense, but the priorities. Did this money really go to where Cariocas needed it the most?
What's the likelihood that people in the east side of Brazil, or the east side of Rio, will really feel left out, and as the games go on, will get more and more angry?
We've had a cycle of big sporting events, starting with the Pan American Games in 2007 here in Rio, the World Cup in 2014, and now the Olympics. And in every case, they've seen investment here in Rio at least go largely towards the west side, not meet the needs of the poorest population, and those needs are tremendous. Before the World Cup, even, Brazilians were out in the streets in 2013, 2014, protesting these priorities and questioning their government's responsiveness to their needs. The mood is not what we had hoped for. There's not that excitement. You know, you don't see flags everywhere. And I think it's because of these broader questions.
Describe just how different it was 7 years ago when the announcement was made that the Olympics would actually come here. It really tells a tale of how quickly fortunes can change in global economics.
Brazil and Rio in 2009 were entirely different places than they are now. You know, I'm staying now in Copacabana. I remember back in 2009, people just exploded in sort of an impromptu carnival, confetti flying, you know, partied all night after the IOC chose Rio as the host. The president at the time, Lula, was tremendously popular. He cried when he heard that the Olympics were coming to Rio. And he said things like, you know, Brazil's moment has come. You know, the world has recognized Brazil's place. Fast forward to 2016, you know, the past couple of years, we've seen massive protests also along Copacabana, you know, for the impeachment of his successor, of President Rousseff. We have seen the fortunes of the country turn around completely. As you mentioned, you know, the country is facing a deep recession. Politically, it's unstable. People feel very differently, to the point where that president, Lula, who really campaigned hard for the Olympics to come to Rio de Janeiro, isn't even going to the opening ceremonies. And neither is his successor, Dilma Rousseff.
Juliana, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Juliana Barbosa is author of Dancing with the Devil in the City of God, Rio de Janeiro on the Brink.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron, who knows that incredible ingredients make incredible meals. Blue Apron works with a community of artisanal suppliers, family-run farms, sustainable fisheries, and ethical ranchers to deliver perfectly portioned seasonal ingredients and easy-to-follow recipe cards right to your door. Choose recipes based on your preferences with no weekly commitment. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free, plus free shipping, by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
The opening ceremonies of the Summer Olympic Games in Rio begin tonight, as we mentioned, and while we've been discussing plenty of doubts surrounding the success of the Games, as our culture reporter Melissa Locker explains, there's one thing we can all count on.
I think a lot of people forget that every single Olympic has a theme song. And honestly, the theme songs, along as much as I love fencing and gymnastics, I also love the theme songs because they're everything from like really anodyne anthems to sort of heartwarming, epic songs that are just played constantly during the games, either at the opening ceremonies or the closing ceremonies. And some of them even turn out to be massive chart toppers.
Does Rio have a theme?
Rio has two themes. One is the official theme song for the Rio 2016 games. It's from a Brazilian samba star and a Brazilian rapper who teamed up for a song called Alma e Coração. Fazer acontecer, lutar
e conquistar, mantenho a fé. You say it has two songs, though, there for Rio.
Right, because the Brazil has their official theme song, and then the U.S. has their own theme song, which I believe the NBC commissioned for the Olympic coverage, and it is by Katy Perry. The song is called Rise. It's very anthemic. It's beautiful. It, you know, gives Eye of the Tiger a run for its money. It's basically Katy Perry's roar, but for the Olympics.
This is not going to be played when they're on the medal stand. It's still the national anthem, right?
It will still be the national anthem when they take gold medals, but I kind of like the idea that Katy Perry is going to be played every single time the U.S. wins an Olympic medal, I have to say.
Take me back to 2004.
The Olympic Games were in Athens. Greece is where the Olympic Games actually started.
Right.
And so they decided to not exactly have someone local make the anthem, but they went for this artist. One breath away
from Mother Oceania. Bjork is so weird.
She is, and she's Icelandic and wonderful, and the theme song is just completely out there. But of course, you know, the theme songs aren't always that strange. There's something much more kind of classic, and songs that you may never know were actually written for the Olympics, like Whitney Houston's One Moment in Time, which was part of the Seoul 1988 games.
So that was written for those games.
It was, and I think most people have no idea that it was associated with an Olympics because it became one of Whitney Houston's sort of classic songs. But if you listen to it now and you think about, you know, kind of people with their hands over their hearts and their, you know, the fireworks going off, it's a beautiful song and it kind of captures the moment.
General nationalistic schmaltz, which we need more of these days, right?
Well, if you're into schmaltz at all but not the nationalistic type, you have to check out this song from the 1984 games in Los Angeles.
That is so that, cheesy 80s. Is that the Caught Between the Moon and New York City guy?
Yeah, it's Christopher Cross. It's called A Chance for Heaven. And it's just so quintessentially 80s that I personally love it. I think it just captures that moment and era so perfectly that it's hilarious to listen to.
Barcelona really went upscale, it seems to me. Freddie Mercury is close to my heart. Let's listen. Barcelona, it was the first. So overdone.
Yeah, this song is interesting because it was actually written a few years before the Olympics, but when Barcelona was awarded the games and they were like, hey, we need a theme song, this was the song that they turned to. They're like, we obviously need Freddie Mercury and Montserrat Caballé doing Barcelona.
Hearing Freddie Mercury belt it out, though, makes me happy.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely. Melissa Locker, culture reporter for Time, The Guardian, and The Takeaway. Have a great Olympics.
Thanks, John. You too.
Did I urinate on your rug?
Did you personally come and pee on my rug?
Hello! Do you speak English, sir?
Parla usted inglés? Your revolution is over, Mr. Lebowski. Condolences. The bomb's lost. My advice to you is to do what your parents did. Get a job, sir.
Oh, my goodness. The classic voice silenced forever. That's David Huddleston, otherwise known as the Big Lebowski. It was announced today that Huddleston died earlier this week at the age of 85 from heart disease. Rafer Guzman, field critic for Newsday. You're here normally on Friday. Just a moment.
Moment of silence. Also one of the town leaders in Blazing Saddles, Mr. Huddleston. Do you remember him as one of the many Johnsons in Blazing Saddles?
Very successful bit part roles all throughout television and movies.
He really tied that movie together.
So let's begin with the movie offerings for this week, Big Guzman.
Thank you.
What do we got? Suicide Squad, which is just that my son has to see this.
Of course.
It's got to be the most ridiculous movie I've ever heard of, but what do you think? Give me the premise.
Well, this is basically the Dirty Dozen set in the DC Comics universe. Mm-hmm. Viola Davis plays Amanda Waller. She's a government agent. She's going to round up all the bad guys at Bellevue Penitentiary, and she's going to send them out on a mission to be the good guys for once, accomplish a dangerous suicide mission. So you've got Harley Quinn, that's Margot Robbie. You've got El Diablo, played by Jade Hernandez. A whole cast of characters.
Jared Leto is in this?
Jared Leto is the Joker, although he is not actually part of the Suicide Squad. He is sort of pestering them from the sidelines, trying to rescue his girlfriend, Harley Quinn, back from the Suicide Squad, which I think kind of is a hint here that this movie is a little all over the map. I can't even list for you the entire members of the Suicide Squad who come and go.
Behold the voice of God.
For those of you who don't know me officially, my name is Amanda Waller.
There's an event in Midway City. I want you to enter the city, rescue HVT-1, and get them to safety.
I'm sorry. For those of us who don't speak good guy, what is HVT-1?
The only person that matters in the city, the one person you can't kill. Complete the mission, you get time off your prison sentence. Fail the mission, you die.
Sounds very complex for the old Dirty Dozen.
I completely forgot, in fact, that Will Smith plays Deadshot, the hitman, the biggest star in the film. It's very hard to keep track of what's going on here. There are good guys in the Suicide Squad. There are bad guys in the Suicide Squad. There's a villain who is the villain to the villains, but she's also the love interest of Rick Flagg, who's one of the good guys in the Suicide Squad. It's very tangled. It doesn't work. David Ayer is the director, a director I like, Training Day, Street Kings, End of Watch. I think he tries to bring that sort of realism to the film, but it's a comic book movie, and it just doesn't quite work for me. I feel like structurally the film is just a real mess.
And if you just sit there and watch it, it doesn't work.
You know, Warner Brothers liked this movie enough, and they liked Margot Robbie enough, who plays Harley Quinn, to give her her own franchise, basically a female-led superhero, supervillain franchise. I didn't get that. I felt like the actors were trying to bring something new to these characters. Jared Leto's Joker is a little fuzzy. He's got kind of a flat top, but he's got rapper teeth. He's a clown. It's all very hard to keep track of.
The next movie, Indignation. Here's a clip.
So, there you are.
Yeah, strange. Here I am. In my own house.
I have been everywhere looking for you.
Why? 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 Somebody, tell me why.
Because if anything were to happen to you...
Oh, come on.
If anything were to ever happen to you...
What is this all about?
It's about life, Marky. It's about the tiniest mistake that can have consequences.
Oh, Christ, you sound like a fortune cookie.
Do I? Like a fortune cookie?
So, what's the premise here?
It's a little tough to say, but I'll boil it down by saying that's Logan Lerman, who plays Marcus Mester, a kid from New Jersey. The year is 1951. While his cousins are all dying in Korea, he's the smart one. He gets to go to college. But like his father in that scene says, all these little mistakes that a kid can make, he makes some of them. And this is based on a Philip Roth novel, so you know that nothing's ever simple in a Roth novel. The themes in this movie really, they dovetail, they come apart, they layer over each other. I loved this film. Philosophical, great, fascinating film.
Performances make it happen.
Great performances. And the playwright Tracy Letts is in this film as the dean. He's fantastic in it.
Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. Thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
Set some comedians down in a room and tell them to be funny. Now. Don't tell jokes, just be funny. This is the daunting challenge improv actors face each night, stepping to the edge of a cliff and jumping off and hoping the audience follows them. When it works, you get Mike Nichols and Elaine May. You get the legendary Second City. The movie Don't Think Twice is about six 30-something New Yorkers banded together in an obscure improv crew called The Commune, trying to make it in the hardest of all genres, betting their futures on pratfalls. It's the latest from producer Mike Birbiglia, who has already profiled the world of stand-up comedy in his movie Sleepwalk With Me. Here are film stars Jillian Jacobs and Keegan-Michael Kay from Key & Peele riffing on the surreality of apartment hunting in New York.
So as you can see, we have there's two bedrooms.
Lovely.
Here is the kitchen.
Is that a toilet?
Yes, that is. The toilet is in the kitchen. Yes.
And yes. Who are they?
They are orphans. They are orphans.
did you say orphans?
Yes, the apartment comes with orphans.
Oh.
Yes.
They feel and act like a family, but they all won't make it into the big time, and that tests them all. The setting is familiar. Instead of Saturday Night Live being the Emerald City for these laughing adventurers in comedy, the show is called Weekend Live. But Tammy Sager, who writes on Girls and Inside Amy Schumer and co-stars in the film, says this film conveys a lot more warmth than Saturday Night Live.
I think Mike was inspired by what he saw around at UCB. It's definitely happened at the Groundlings. It's definitely happened at I.O., Improv Olympic, and it's definitely happened, as I've seen and experienced it myself, at Second City.
So this is really a renaissance for this kind of improv. I saw a documentary about Chris Farley, the late Chris Farley, which really described just how much there was this mentoring and a real sense of family that took place at Second City in that, you know, two generations ago class of Saturday Night Live.
Absolutely.
It seems it's much more a calmer, hipstery, more kind of family at this point.
It is. It's also much larger because there's so much more improv around now.
There's something about millennials that they think that they can do this for the rest of their lives.
Good for them.
So how did you produce a script here? Was this really very script-driven, or did you rely on a lot of the improv to make it work?
No, Mike wrote like 10, I don't even know, 13 drafts of it. So it was very, very, it was completely scripted.
And the characters were the characters, and that was the way it was going to be.
Yeah, I was lucky enough because I know Mike. We are in an improv group together for the past few years. We perform at UCB in New York. And so he had me and Chris Gethard, who's another member of the Commune in the movie, come to, I think we were basically at almost all of the readings that he would do at his house. He would invite people over, and Mike Birbiglia attracts a lot of amazing people. So he would also have people that he called friends that I call amazing and famous, like Nicole Hall of Center and Frank Oz and Ira Glass, of course. Mm-hmm. And they would come and give notes. And then we'd have pizza afterwards. And so I got to see the script in lots of incarnations. And so the characters didn't start that way. But by the time that we were filming, they were very drawn out.
In this movie, this is comedy that you root for, that is very emotional, but it's not like, you know, ha, 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 ha. It's not like laugh riot comedy. You're really, you know when a skit works and not.
Absolutely. It is, I think, also how they shoot the improv is very much that I feel like the audience is part of us. And so, yeah, you're right. It's not the feeling of like, oh my gosh, look at what they're doing. It's like, look at the fun we're having.
So are you a movie star now?
Oh, completely.
Completely. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
Do you think the chemistry and the qualities of this show relate to some of Ira Glass's work that's very familiar to our audience, of course?
I really do. It's so fun to see Mike and Ira interact because they're really like a married couple, because Ira would be at those table reads and did not want to produce a movie again. I think, you know, it's not fun necessarily, or it's not what his idea of fun is. And he would come to these table reads and really give Mike a hard time afterwards and be like, this isn't a movie, that's not, I don't think this is going to work. Like, basically act like a hot girl who doesn't want to be involved.
In a very Philip Roth sort of depressing yes. kind of way.
Philip Roth, hot girl.
Yeah, Philip Roth, hot girl who says no a lot.
Yes. And then Mike just sort of would keep revising and using these notes, and then Ira was sucked in.
And was there any concern that Keegan-Michael Key, was there any concern that he would ham it up, that he would try to steal the scenes, that he, coming from such a sketch comedy world?
Definitely not from me. I've known Keegan actually 15 years.
Really?
Yeah, from back when he was at Detroit and I was in Chicago at Second City. And I've known him from improvising back in Chicago, and then at Mad TV we were there together. And Keegan's background is actually drama. Mm. Like, he went to graduate school and he thought he was going to do Chekhov and Shakespeare. And God willing, he still will. And what I think makes him so brilliant as a sketch performer is that he is first and foremost an actor.
Mm. And he's got to be the most courageous. I mean, to do that bit with the president,
I know.
Because, I mean, that ball drops once. Yeah. And you're just done. Secret Service will come and take you away.
Right. No, he is fearless. He's absolutely fearless as a performer. Absolutely. Full of fear as a person. But
really? Well, all you comedians.
All of us. We are a pretty miserable bunch.
Right. So will this become like my big fat Greek comedy sketch blockbuster monster movie?
That would be great for, I'm sure, people who will make money that aren't me. But I hope it becomes like The Big Chill, where it's, you know, a movie that people come back to and discover and just feel like a group of friends that reflects back their lives.
What's better than The Big Chill? Oh. I think you've already got that one.
That's really kind.
All right. Tammy Sager, thanks so much.
Thank you so much. What a pleasure.
Tammy Sager co-stars in the new movie Don't Think Twice, which opens today. She also writes on Girls and Inside Amy Schumer. This is the story of how some Jamaican jam musicians became a fountain of music and eventually flooded the world with the sounds of reggae and ska. Clement Dodd was behind the mixing board at Studio One Studios in 1954, as Studio One became the source for some of the most popular music in the world. Chris Wilson was around in those days as a teenager. Today, he's one of the last of the A&R guys, artists and repertoire at Studio One. Wilson is the producer of an album that showcases the treasures of Studio One's greatest musical moments. The album Moneymaker is being re-released today, and Wilson says the legacy of Studio One has been a long time in the making.
What happened is that before recordings really happened in Jamaica, the big band era was, you know, strong in Jamaica. And you had, you know, big bands and you had smaller combos that played live music. But when American music started to change from more of that jazz-based form to more, you know, R&B, and the people in Jamaica really liked that better than the jazz. So they came in and started to play records at dances instead of actually going to hear bands. That was really the birth of Studio One and Mr. Dodd.
But Studio One was a stripped-down kind of raw operation.
Yeah, it was based more on what was going on, especially in the early years in the late 50s. It was basically they were cutting American R&B. It wasn't ska that we know today. It was really a very Americanized form. But as time went on, the Jamaican influence started to creep in, and it became, you know, what we know as ska. And ska really came in 1962, 1961.
Oh, little girl, you have me in a rage.
Just around the time of independence. So Jamaica's cultural identity came into fore at the same time that Jamaica became, you know, independent. And Studio One was really very instrumental in giving the soundtrack to the independence movement in Jamaica.
Is that timing why so much reggae music is really about something? It's not simply old girlfriends and this and that?
Well, what happened is that when I was growing up, you would hear stuff like Peggy Lee and Frank Sinatra on the radio. So Jamaican music, which wasn't really popularly played on the major stations, became more a ghetto form. And what happened is that people were interested in what was happening around them. And Jamaicans are very politicalized. They would take what was happening in the street and put it into records. And they became like newspapers more than actually just music.
Was this directed by Studio One, the idea of where do we go next? What's the mission? What content do we embrace? Or was it the artists that were doing this?
Well, you have to remember also that, you know, Mr. Dodd, who was the founder of Studio One, he was a black man living in a world where black men had not really been taken that seriously. Black man's bread. Black man's rent. Black man's bread. Black man's rent. Set us free. Set us free. Especially up until 1962, when England was still the ruler of Jamaica, blacks really didn't have that much impact on the life of Jamaica. So these people, these pioneers like Mr. Dodd, used his own version of himself, his own blackness, to create his own product, which was really different than what, you know, the prevailing recording mood was in Jamaica for other labels.
What was his style? I mean, was he a thumbs up, thumbs down, kind of no words, sort of mysterious fellow sitting in the corner? Or did he actively engage with the musicians?
All of the above. You know, it depended on his mood and how the things worked. You know, he wouldn't say anything if things were going well, but, you know, he was vocal if things weren't going the way he liked. His most important facet of his thinking about music was the bass. And he brought the bass to the forefront. So what we hear today...
So that's him.
In reggae,
that's his idea? That the bass takes the melody in reggae?
Oh, yeah, yeah. He was very concerned about making it danceable. And he wanted the bass and drums to really have an impact. So what we think of Jamaican music today, which is, you know, reggae and the big bass and all of that, he was the one who really pioneered that approach to the music. He didn't like a melodic bass and guys who were playing, you know, all different types of notes. He wanted it raw, straight up.
What were the hits, the big records that came out of Studio One that you can, I mean, it's a really long list, but...
Oh, God, it's there. There's, I mean, he put out about 3,000 singles. So you can only imagine. But I would say in the ska period, you would have like Simmer Down by the Wailers. Stuff by Toots and the Maytals, the Scatolites. Then going into Rocksteady, you had Alton Ellis, all of his stuff. He was sort of like a Marvin Gaye of Jamaica. And the band The Soul Vendors. I wasn't born to be lonely, lonely baby. They had a lot of big instrumentals that, you know, kind of people use today and sing different lyrics over them. Then he started reggae with stuff like Nanny Goat by Larry Marshall. And which was probably, it's credited to be at least the first major reggae song. Maybe somebody along the line had a song recorded in similar style and tempo and, you know, the way it was constructed before him, but he was the one who dominated these particular periods.
Well, we're grateful for your passion, Chris Wilson.
Good.
Thank you so
much. Thank you so much.
Chris Wilson is director of A&R at Studio One. So here's something to take with you today. Maybe it's an improvement. I don't quite know. Facebook, it's putting clickbait on the back burner with plans to change its newsfeed algorithm so the shock and awe and annoyance of catchy headlines appear less frequently in user feeds. It's another step by the media mega company to better tailor content to users, but it's bad news for publishers who rely heavily on Facebook traffic. That's all for today, but if you want to take the takeaway with you, subscribe to our podcast. You can find us on iTunes or any other service you use to get your podcast. Take us with you on your commute home from work, the beach, wherever. 877-8-MY-TAKE is our number. Leave us a comment. Tell us a story at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. Have a great weekend. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.